Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Boomer and the Vape Show, giving voice to 78 million boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Each day we have a different guest and a different topic. Our guests always have a nugget or two for anyone, regardless of where you are. We hope you enjoy the relaxed conversational style of the show. Nothing fancy, just boomers sitting around the table talking about stuff. Now, here are the Boomer and the Vape, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
Yes, indeed, it is the Boomer the Vape Show one more time on Blog Talk Radio. It's Tuesday, October 5th, 2010, and we're broadcasting from the Boomer and the Vape Enterprises studio in Phoenix, Arizona. We'll be getting to our guest in just a minute, but before we do, I always like to remind people and invite them to come to our website, www.boomerandthebabe.com, sign up for our free online magazine, which is the Boomer and the Babe Journal, and then take a little look around and see everything else that the Boomer and the Babe Enterprises is involved in. And I'm Pete Peters.
And I'm Deborah Brown.
And today's guest is Mr. Richard Earle. Richard Earle is the grandson of Mr. Harley Earle, who is in the day, the lead designer, developed all kinds of concepts and concept cars for General Motors. We're going to have an exciting program today talking to Richard about his grandfather and all the things that he was involved in, which was actually more than just designing automobiles. And I've been doing a little bit of research on Harley Earle. I've been amazed to find that there's even a connection with my grandfather and Harley Earle in General Motors at Ford in Detroit. We're going to be talking a little bit about the rise and fall of General Motors, the rise and fall of the city of Detroit, and how the automotive industry has played a tremendous role in everything that Detroit has become to this very day. So welcome to the show, Richard Earle. How are you today?
I'm great. Thanks. Thanks for inviting me on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, we're looking forward to this hour, that's for sure. Deborah?
Well, the first thing I always like to ask is for what we call your two-minute movie, and that is your life, laser beam style, as far back as you want to go, coming up to today. And it's not going to be the rise and fall of Richard Earle, because there is no there's no fall, right? So just tell us a little bit about yourself, please.
Well, thanks, Deborah. I was born in Detroit and in 1959, and my parents actually moved to Florida when I was two. And you know, my grandfather at that time had just moved down to Palm Beach, Florida, and so basically grew up in Palm Beach, West Palm Beach area, and developed, you know, one of the most personal connections possible with one of America's greatest contemporary artist designers. You know, Harley, he assembled and completed the world's first automobile design department at General Motors. But getting back to myself, I really learned about my grandfather, I don't want to say late in life, but kind of in a mature period, because my dad and my uncle, Harley's only two kids, had they never talked much about their father, and I grew up learning about him from the women in my family. And also, Harley died when I was 10 years old in 1969, but I spent a lot of time growing up in his driveway. And then fast forward into the mid-80s, when I was in my 20s, I got to go tour the GM Tech Center. And I got to see these sexy, ultra-futuristic clay model prototypes in 1985 on a visit to Warren, Michigan. And that's when I really decided to ensure that my heritage, family's heritage, continues, because it was actually over 110 years ago that my great-grandfather, J.W., started the Earl Carriage Works in a small community known today as Hollywood, California. And this, of course, is where Harley was first initiated into the field of auto body engineering and design at an early age. But, you know, I started researching my grandfather's story when I was 35, and that was 15 years ago, and I've been researching and writing a historical book, which is intended to become a movie, and as well as a biography, and interviewed over 150 people, you know, unparalleled trove of archival evidence on the central universe of what makes the modern auto industry tick today, which is design. And in the last 15 years, I put together a museum-quality traveling photo exhibit, launched the official Harley Earl website, Car of the Century, and then, you know, helped develop the Harley Earl television advertising campaign in 2001-2002 that starred Tiger Woods in those Buick TV commercials. And currently, I like making appearances like this and being the spokesperson and or curator of Harley Earl's art form at auto events like Barrett Jackson. And just really excited to get this book out and this story, which is on America's automotive design legacy as well as the world's. And I think that's my elevator story.
Well, let's go back, as they say, go back in time. You mentioned Earl Carriage Works, which was your great-grandfather's operation in Hollywood, California. And that's where your grandfather then cut his teeth, probably, around the mode of transportation of the day and moving forward. So let's take about a minute, if you don't mind, and tell us a little bit about the Carriage Works and what you found out there, and how did your father assimilate into that, or your grandfather,
well,
I'm sorry.
Well, you know, Harley was brilliant and went to Stanford, not surprisingly, dropped out. And it's a bit sketchy whether he graduated or not. There's newspaper stories saying he graduated, and then there's stories where he left because he had septicemia and that he got cleated in a rugby game and almost lost his leg because, you know, certainly back then they didn't have the the medicine they have today. But anyway, that's really when he grew up in his father's automobile works company. It was called the Earl Automobile Works, and it was on Main and Pico in Los Angeles in a place called Auto Row, which, you know, back in the teens was becoming the largest area to fabricate cars on the West Coast. And the Earl's Auto Works didn't sell cars traditionally speaking. They built one-of-a-kind creations, and this was Harley's doing after cutting his teeth under his father working in the carriage shop and for a number of years with his brothers and whatnot. And he came up with a novel idea to build the full-size clay models of cars, which was still a novel idea today because they held the test of time. They still do it in the auto designing around the world, and at every car company, I might add, in the global automotive car industry today. And what he did was he stumbled upon a new way to build cars. And anyway, fast forward to he's in his teens, he started building cars for movie stars and millionaires, and you know, some of his neighbors, the DeMilles, lived down the street from the Earls in Hollywood. And anyway, he started making these cars that were also going to auto shows at the time and winning all sorts of awards for their not only appearance because they were far ahead of their time, but also because of how advanced they were and innovative in their engineering that was taking place in the car as far as mechanically and all the different gadgets and appointments that people, especially wealthy clientele, really enjoyed. And you know, Harley designed cars for Fatty Arbuckle, Mary Miles, Minter, you know, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., Tom Mix. These were all the heavy hitters of the day. And at that time, the Earl Automobile Works was called, you know, around town, Earl's Hot Rod Shop.
Back then, it was a hot rod shop because he was making all these souped up deals that he was putting together almost piece by piece. Is that right?
Exactly. They were customizing vehicles, and for example, how he was attracted the attention originally of these a great family back in Detroit, and they used to say back in the East in those days. But, you know, he attracted the attention of the Fisher brothers, who were, you know, some of the largest shareholders of General Motors back in the early 20s, because he would order 100 naked chassis from the Cadillac motor car company. And he was like, we don't want the bodies, just send us the chassis, and we'll take care of the bodies on our own. Well, the 100... chassis back then in the late teens was quite a big order. It caught the attention of Larry Fisher, who was the principal of Cadillac at that time, which was the luxury car brand of General Motors, but Packard at the time was the luxury car leader in this country. Anyway, you know, Larry was so intrigued, he wanted to find out more, and he actually went out to California, met with you know, the principals of the Earl Automobile Company, which actually had merged with the largest Cadillac dealer on the West Coast, which was the Don Lee Cadillac Company on the West Coast, largest dealership in the West.
It's amazing you mentioned the term or the name of the company, Packard. Here again is another instance where our paths at some level of cross, and that is that my father worked for Packard Motor Company. He worked for them on the drawing boards before he left and then eventually went to Ford Motor. But nonetheless, he worked for Packard. So, I mean, there's all kinds of little nuances in this story that make it amazing to me, because not only was I born in Detroit, raised in Detroit, was integrally involved through my parents and my grandfather with the automotive industry, because that was the primary employers of the time back in Detroit, and we all had our living, and we all derived our sustenance from the automotive industry in Detroit. And I know we're going to get in a little bit more into the story about how that went over the cliff, so to speak, but
we'll talk about that a little later.
Yeah, exactly. Right now we're talking about how your grandfather got involved with General Motors, the Fisher brothers from Fisher, Body by Fisher, for those of our listeners that may know and have heard anything about the automobile industry, was the premier, was it an engineering group, I guess, that they did some design themselves and so on and so forth. But they were the ones then, as you said, that brought your grandfather to Detroit. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And I will mention, I think it's intriguing, certainly, because let's just go back and talk just real quickly about the Ford Motor Car Company in the 20s. Of course, Henry Ford started Model T building in 1908 and started his company. And what you had was half the cars on the roadways by the mid-20s had the Ford brand on them, and they were Model Ts. And he was also the first billionaire in Michigan. And you know, many people realized that he was the guy to follow, and he had clearly identified that not only in the media but in sales success and statistics, no doubt. But the innovators or the principals of General Motors were starting to look for ways to compete, and not only compete because they were a middle-of-the-pack car company in the mid-20s, they wanted to become the number one car company in the world. And Harley Earl was their ticket, because he showed them a new way, or he opened the door and showed them what was in the door of the future. And they basically hitched a ride on Harley's dream, which was and he presented this idea to the principals of General Motors, the largest shareholders, the Fisher brothers, Alfred Sloan, and some other large shareholders of General Motors, and said that, you know, the cars I designed for movie stars and millionaires, I can have coming off of your assembly lines in volume production. And these were about the most drop-dead gorgeous motoramic masterpieces that the world had ever seen before. And, you know, just like today, some of the first families of this country and around the world were finding out that Harley's creations were above and beyond the rest of the custom car fields, and they wanted them. So they kind of beat a path to his door, and General Motors was like, they were like, we got to get the technology that Harley has as far as building the cars, because he has a whole new idea of what's going to sell the car in the future, and that was design.
It's interesting because it's pretty well known that around that time, Henry Ford would say that you could have any color you want in my automobile as long as it's black. And when you look at the designs of the automobiles that Henry Ford was putting out, they were staid and boxy and black. And then you look at the designs and the futuristic type things that your grandfather was designing, and it was just, there's a day and night difference, and obviously people thought a lot of that and got involved in that by buying a lot of those cars and starting to move GM right to the top of the heap, didn't they?
Well, that, Pete, you're absolutely right. It was a major transition in Detroit. It was a paradigm-busting shift, what Harley offered to recreate or revolutionize within General Motors, he came to General Motors as a consulting engineer to Cadillac in 1925. By 1936, Ford had been toppled, and General Motors was the undisputed heavyweight champion of the automobile world, and Cadillac and the car that the companion car that Harley Early created that originally got him the job at General Motors or a Cadillac was the LaSalle, which was from day one, it was like a marketing test. This was the car that he was like contracted to build that Cadillac would sell, and it was a marketing test. If it sold successfully in 1927 when it was launched, Harley could come to Detroit and to GM. He was invited to do anything he basically wanted, or primarily kind of revolutionize the auto world, but first do it at GM. And I think what's exciting is, you know, when I've researched this story, one of the things that I came to understand quite well was, you know, back in the day when Harley Earl was first coming to Detroit, these cars that not only Ford was creating, everybody was creating, where the industry was as far as technologically was rather unsophisticated and crude. And it was almost like, you know, you had these horny-handed engineers. You know, they were fabricating the car and the look of the car up at the factory. And, of course, they didn't know a good-looking car from a canoe. And Harley basically took this entire new industry or area and turned it into an industry, a new profession, which was called automobile design, and started it inside General Motors. And today, we're talking nearly 80 years later, we have an industry that still follows, I call it the central universe of automaking. It's the automobile design profession. Every car company in the world has one, and it's built into the hierarchy of their company, and they cannot sell cars in the modern marketplace unless they have this exact same profession that Harley Earl had perfected and created, this pattern of building cars, pre-designing, pre-engineering, pre-styling ahead of time before they even were properly engineered to come off the automobile assembly line.
Well, I remember as a youngster going to the auto shows in Detroit again with my dad. We would go and see the automobiles, and it was that time of year when the new car launch came out, and everybody was wondering, what's the new Cadillac going to look like? What's the new General Motors products going to look like? What's the Ford products? And what are they going to look like this year? Are they going to have the wings, or are they going to not have the wings after Harley had first introduced them? It created an excitement that it doesn't seem to be the case today. I mean, they started going into mid-year launches and half-year models and all this other kind of stuff, and they really diluted everything that was going on with the launch process and the big it was a big grand production, wasn't it?
It was an annual popularity contest, and Harley Earl had created it. He's the father of mass production in the modern today, as far as product design is concerned. By first doing it in the automobile industry, it set the pattern for the rest of the world to perfect it. The computer industry wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for what the automobile, the sophisticated quantum leap in technology that the automobile had made from the late 20s to during the war through the 50s. I just want to mention this. I think it's kind of interesting. You know, when Harley Earl first moved to Detroit, you know, one of the things I think is, honestly, I've had other people tell me this as well. They were like, you know, when he moved to Detroit, he introduced forks and knives to this industry because it was so crude and unsophisticated. And the modern sleds that were coming down the roadway that he was creating inside General Motors were setting the stage, or they were the pace setters of every car that would come off an assembly line in Detroit afterwards. Every car company after GM started this department for Harley, which was originally called the Art and Color Section of General Motors, Chrysler, which Wally Chrysler, by the way, had originally been at General Motors before he started his car company, I believe, in the early 20s. And it's not surprising that Chrysler's car company, after Harley started the Art and Color Section, General Motors started their Art and Color Section, called it the Art and Color Section of Chrysler in the early 30s, and then after the Airstream or we'll get to that later. But the thing is. The Chrysler Airflow. They went back and changed it to engineering, the name of their, you know, where they fabricate the look of their cars. But the bottom line is that, you know, nobody in the country today, and this is one of the reasons I was intrigued about doing the show, I just like to share this knowledge because General Motors does not do a good job of telling their history. And no doubt that has something to do with their eventually going, you know, taking a 40-year market share loss and then eventually going business bankrupt in the 2008-2009. But the point that I want to make is that this didn't, you know, come out of nowhere. Harley created this central universe of automaking, and it happened. It's an American original, another way of saying what he did. And remember, he's the father of the annual model change, and every industry, it's like the life, not only is it the lifeblood of the automobile industry around the world today, but it's the lifeblood of capitalism. And you know, it was also called planned obsolescence, or Harley liked to call it dynamic obsolescence or design obsolescence. I'm sorry, I might be going off the track a little bit right now.
Richard, I was just going to say, it seems like that was the start of planned obsolescence. That's what I was trying to get in there and say, how amazing the keeping up with the Joneses, and you know how you you look forward to getting your first car and all that stuff. If it had stayed the other way, you know, without the art and color section of all of these manufacturers, they would have just been all modes of transportation. But instead, they were works of art on wheels, and you got to choose the colors and the interior and all that stuff because of your grandfather.
Well, that's right. There's another point that I wanted to make too, Deborah, and that was, I believe this is a correct statement, Richard. Before the use of clay models and shaping prototypes and futuristic automobiles and so on and so forth, didn't they used to build those models out of wood?
Wood and metal, by the
wood
way,
and metal.
Which obviously are a heck of a lot less malleable than clay. You know, it's softer and lends to creating forms easier. And that's another thing. You know, taking the idea from concept to reality under Harley's aegis or the advent of Harley moving to Detroit and creating this paradigm busting shift, which really was was what broke the Ford dominance, number one position in the auto world's back, and General Motors became the number one car company, not only in America but the world, in the 30s, and it all had to do with design. It all had to do with creating this new profession, which, like you said, you know, Henry Ford offered the car, and it was his sales. It was an unconventional kind of a backwoods folksy type of like, look, you can have it in any color as long as it's black. Ha ha ha. But you know. I mean, as far as sophistication in business, it was Harley Earl and the principals of General Motors who were backing him and letting him run this new campaign to drive GM into the future. Again, GM hitched a ride on Harley's dream, not vice versa. GM did not make Harley Earl. He made General Motors. He was just an extremely secretive individual and was constantly... After living in Hollywood, remember Tinseltown, which is the entertainment capital of the world today. He was like one of the first families in Hollywood, and left this place to go to, you know, Michigan to create his dream, which was, you know, that basically streamlines democracy, which is, you know, one man can make an enormous difference in our society and culture, which Harley's story is one. And the thing is that he knew he could make a difference. And I just think, you know, I'm extremely passionate about this because I think in an area that used to be so important not only to the economy of America and help drive the engine of the national economy, but also to the world today, you know, not many people understand where these business innovations and concepts came from. And it's a real travesty. And I just want to mention, here's a guy, for example, and we're kind of taking this timeline, and it's great in this broadcast because it's unfolding this man's story one layer at a time. But remember, this is the individual that came up with the idea, the business paradigm for the concept car. And he's the father of the concept car. Now, talk about lifeblood of the automobile industry, the concept car, the prototyping and dream car or dream product today, you know, it's global. It's from Nike tennis shoes to, you know, Samsung televisions to sophisticated iPhones and Evos. I mean, it's all about this constant improvement. And it's not like it was born in Japan. And it was born in America. You know, this is a story about an individual who created the art of making cars. That's why he's not only a sophisticated engineer. I call him an artist engineering impresario because he was such a renaissance man, top dog salesman, an ambassador of Detroit.
Well, I will say this, a couple of things. First of all, Detroit could use an ambassador. The automobile industry could use some ambassadorship right now. That's number one. Number two, another place when you talk about your father, your grandfather going to General Motors in Detroit and developing the art and design area of of General Motors. My grandfather worked for General Motors in the design area. He was a craftsman, an old Scandinavian craftsman from Finland, and he designed, and I know I was going to send you some pictures of these things, I never did, but he designed some tools that that he used when he was shaping the metal and putting these concept, I'm believing now, putting these concept cars together or developing them so that they could take them to some of these shows, because this was taking place in the 50s, the mid to late 50s when all that was going on, that that my grandfather was working there. And I still have some of his tools.
Show business on wheels.
I'm sorry?
Show business on wheels.
Show business on wheels. Absolutely was. It absolutely was, and there's no doubt about it. So now, as it exists today, it's certainly different than it was back in the day, but along the way now, because of everything else that was going on and because of the wars and so on and so forth, your grandfather got involved in a lot of national security type things. We've yet to talk about the espionage and so on and so forth as it involved automotive espionage and secrecy. Everybody wanted his designs, didn't they? Everybody wanted to know what Harley Earl was doing in Ford and Chrysler, and they spent a lot of money and took a lot of chances to try to figure out what it was that that Harley Earl was going to come up with next. And tell us a little bit about how that worked, and I'll throw a little anecdote in there of my own that I can remember about the times.
Well, that sounds great, Pete. Yeah, I'd love to. It's interesting what you just said, you know, making the cars look prettier, making people be concerned about the look of the car. You know, up till, you know, Henry Ford in the late 20s when he came up with a successor to the Model T, and he stopped production on the Ford plant for 6 months, which was, you know, just imagine the amount of money they were losing every day by not putting cars out, you know, trying to come up with a successor to the Model T. That was all because of Harley Earl working over at General Motors on this new area that was all about launching new products annually, I might add. And who knows, maybe after that, if Harley hadn't been meddled with at the end of the 50s, you know, we might have had launches of cars every 6 months. New models, I might add, but that's another story. But getting back to the late 20s, you know, this espionage is so important because, you know, just like you said, nobody cared about the look of a Ford. That wasn't a part of the it wasn't planned into the sales of the automobile in any way, shape, or form in the mid-20s. And literally, you could walk anywhere into any part of the Ford plant if you were not employed by the Ford company. There was no security. It was something that they paid little attention to. I'm not saying there wasn't any security, but it was like you could get into the secret areas of the Ford development of new products. There wasn't a new product development area with inside the company. And with Chrysler following the Ford in the mid-20s, and everybody kind of like, you know, not worrying about the look of the car, that's really where Harley stole the show. Because by the end of the 20s, after this LaSalle had come out and had been a real smash hit, sold like 26,000 units its first year in 1927, and was the first car to ever be professionally designed by a contemporary artist, like I said, artist engineer impresario, General Motors was dedicated to this new direction that was all about the advanced look and keeping these forward designs a secret. And this whole idea came out of Harley's head, and General Motors, again, great ideas by large corporations or any corporation are exploited, great ideas come from individuals, and then they're hatched inside corporations, and then exploited. And that's just what GM did. And Harley, being the person that he was like, I don't want to get all the credit. I'll share the credit with everybody in this corporation, especially the the largest shareholders and principals, elite, or I don't want to say elite, the top executive committee that's running the company. And he wanted them to defray the credit because he didn't want the media beating a path to his door and the paparazzi standing at the end of his driveway bugging him, his wife, and his kids. He wanted to be left alone. Anonymity was, this artist was sacred. But anyway, GM had a proving grounds out in Milford, which you and I both talked about, and Pete. And what's interesting about the proving grounds, this was an area where at the end of the 20s, they started to develop new concept ideas for new car lines and, Harley's designs. And, back in the day, the other big car companies would send photographers over there to photograph what GM was doing. And this was really the beginning of industrial espionage as far as the look of the car is concerned. As you well know today, if you have the 2015 design for the Corvette, you had a picture of it for some reason, you could sell it for probably a couple $100,000 in the media because it's so coveted and sought after. Harley created this entire paradigm behind the look of the car being a secret and these forward designs being kept hush-hush and on the QT. And his department was the area that became GM's, golden goose, but it was also their number one trade secret. Everything that was being hatched at this corporation that was new and innovative and, reaching out into the future, the dream ideas that he was having was being fleshed out in this new department that was artists and engineers. I call them hybrid artists engineers. That's the department that was creating the new direction that GM was going in. And Harley, this was long before any company had a marketing department. And Harley was in charge of not only creating the look of the car, but talking about his motoramic masterpieces, his artworks that were going to be on the roadways in hundreds of thousands of units. And he would often, be involved in, closely involved, I might add, in the advertising of these products and hammering, and I hate to use the word hammering, but design was all, it was like the moment Harley Earl came to this corporation in 27, you look at all the literature and coming out of the PR department back in the 20s at General Motors before Harley Earl, not a mention of design or styling being an important factor in sales. And after Harley came to GM, it was like a Cambrian explosion that happened inside the corporation, and that's all they talked about was the look of the car and why you're going to want a General Motors car. Not only is it going to get you from point A to point B safely, and it's going to be well-engineered, as you already know it is, but it's also going to make a statement, and you're going to be concerned with how people look at you driving this new GM product that's like shoulders above the rest when it comes to making a statement, being distinctive and really turning people's heads, and not just people, but kids' heads as well.
Well, it's pretty, really plain to see based on that why it is then that all of these other car manufacturers wanted to know exactly what was going on at General Motors and exactly what Harley Earl was doing and what the latest designs were. And I can attest to that in the, late 50s, certainly early 60s, we used to go, because being born and raised in Michigan, we had a little family area, a little lake lot, if you will, that we used to go out and spend weekends and maybe spend a day or two out there. And we would drive on our way to that area right past the General Motors Proving Grounds in Milford. And as we drove by, the road that we drove was ran parallel to the high-speed, high-bank turn part of the course. And for those that don't know, You would take these automobiles and race them down. They would take the automobiles, race them right straight down this straightaway, and then they would take them into this high-speed turn. There was a
high-bank corner. Yeah,
high-bank corners, and they could literally take their hands off the steering wheel on these things, and they, depending on how fast they were going, they would go up or come down those banks. But always remain straight because of the way the thing was designed. But when we would go out there and drive past that area and see those cars racing, they were always covered in tarps. Nobody got to see those cars. And I know for a fact that if we'd have gone and tried to peer through the little holes in the fence that were all covered with that green burlap or tarp or whatever it was, I'm sure there would have been somebody tapping us on the shoulder real soon asking us what we were doing there. It was one of those things, it was almost like as you drove by, it was almost hallowed ground. And there's my dad driving his Ford Motor car, working for Ford Motor, and we're going past this thing. It was kind of ironic now that you and I have had some of these conversations. But it's just testament to everything you're saying, and I know it from firsthand that that's exactly what was going on. Now, I've also had the opportunity of going out to the Ford Motor testing grounds in Romeo, Michigan, with my dad driving some of those automobiles with a carload of us in the automobile, and it's quite an experience, especially when you're person driving is not a test driver. It gets a little dicey, but it was certainly fun, and I can still remember it to this day. But it just here again, it is a testament to everything you're saying that is absolutely factual, as I know it to be.
Well, it's like, you know, it's so interesting because you jog my memory as far as this car that Harley created, which was like in 1933, you know, Chrysler was like, you know, gaining market share and their products were highly sought after, and they were, rising up and becoming a major competitor to Ford and General Motors. And Chrysler was so intent on finding out what General Motors was doing that they would send out a spy photographer to the testing grounds. And, and GM styling, or GM Art and Color, had created this car called an All Bonita, which first hit the proving grounds, the roads out there in 1933. And instead of GM, later on they get used to one of the guys out there would drive around with a rifle. You know, he took to carrying a rifle with him in the test cars. You know, he threatened to use it on spies from other companies. His name was Ollie Schoechlin, project director for the All Bonita. But they let the photographers take the pictures of this car, and they got back to Chrysler, and Chrysler was like, this is the new direction. And it was a kind of a revolutionary new design for 33 with a turret top, you know, built-in. And the only thing that was wrong with the car is it was a little homely. But the funny thing is, when you look at this car, and if you go to the web and you want to look this up by any chance, just type in at Google or Yahoo, just the spy photographer meets GM employee with a shotgun, or just spy photographer, and it'll come right up. But the thing is there's very good documentation about this car, and you just look at it, and then you look at the pictures of the 34 Airflow that Chrysler went on to build. And it was a good car engineering-wise, but it was a little homely, and it never sold well. And Chrysler lost a bundle on that car, the 34 Airflow. And it had to do with, you know, GM dodging them into, like, taking this new direction and bankrolling, Chrysler bankrolled the thought that this was going to be the new look. And it wasn't the new look, and it was a very expensive mistake for Chrysler. But anyway, you know, the GM styling section, as it later became known as in 1937, it was changed. Art and Color was changed to 37, and right around that time, Harley became a vice president of General Motors. And this was a time when you had, GM styling was the skunk works of not only General Motors, but it was kind of like the Area 51 for the country, because everybody wanted to find out what the world's largest manufacturer, how it had not only become the largest manufacturer in the world, but where was it going in the future? And instead of all these companies that used to follow Ford and go, my God, this is the, you know, this guy has his hands on the heartbeat of the pulse of the American public, that's really what Harley Earl had. And he was running the show at General Motors, creating these new cars that, you know, were the sales leaders, and GM was gaining market share at an unprecedented rate in the 30s and climbing up, you know, shoulders above the rest going into the late 30s, early 40s, right before World War II.
I just want to take just a minute here and let everybody know that as we're going through this chronology, if you will, we're not going to get through with this whole thing. I can just see that right now. So we're going to have you back again, Richard, at a future date. But for anybody that's interested and finds this on the archives or wherever they find it on Blog Talk, if they would go to your website, there is so much information, and there's great pictures and great history and everything like that. If you're at all a history buff, if you at all are interested in the automobile industry, go to carofthecentury.com. Is that correct? www.carofthecentury.com?
That's correct. Or just go to any of the search engines and type in Harley Earl website. It comes right up.
It's just you can spend hours on that website alone with everything that has been put together on that site. And I can see that it's a massive undertaking. Let's talk a little bit. I think we're kind of into the war years. Let's talk a little bit about what your grandfather did and how he was involved in the war machine, as it were, for World War II. What was his involvement there?
Well, if you do the research, what's so interesting about this story, since Harley was an individual that wanted to keep his anonymity, and, you know, he was fine with just being known as the world's greatest car designer, not only because he was making the cars that everybody wanted to drive in the mid-20th century, but again, all the scholarly research is up at that website. It's got tons of factual evidence to prove all this. But a lot of it has to do with, you know, where GM's gone in the last 50 years. And if you talk to people at GM today, they have no official recollection that, Harley Earl invented the automobile design profession in America with inside General Motors that was taking place inside Detroit. And that had to do with the fact that records were either lost, destroyed, or, you know, so well classified, you know, no one could ever touch them. And that was all Harley Earl's doing, because he had created this new area, which was the design section of General Motors products. It's kind of like what Steve Jobs is doing today at Apple, and how they covet their forward designs, and, you know, they launch them, and there's just a great degree of anticipation. I love using this analogy, because I'm fully convinced that the reason that Apple is such a sales leader today and such a progressive company, as well as so well capitalized, and the stock keeps going up and up, has to do with Steve Jobs tearing out these pages from the Harley Earl playbook, and how he did it at General Motors first, and that's basically how Steve Jobs is doing it today. But the point is that leading up to World War II, you had an individual that was the genius behind the largest company and manufacturer in the world, and that tidbit of information, since Harley wasn't going out there, nor did he want General Motors to promote him and spotlight him as being this individual that was the genius behind their products, it really didn't get circulated too much that he was this design hero behind all of GM's product designs. And we're not just talking cars, people. We're talking everything that GM manufactured. We're talking trains, planes, automobiles, buses, in which, you know, after World War II, GM had a monopoly in the manufacturing of buses and trains in this country. But that's another story. But leading up to World War II, the military arm, or the Defense Department, in the early days of World War II and the fact that we were probably going to get in this war, they were like, Jesus, we're going to have to get somebody to design these products. And secrecy, obviously, was such a necessary part of the process, like it was in England, that, you know, they didn't want go to the Society of Automotive Engineers, for example, which was thousands of engineers, Detroit engineers too, and then, you know, try to get 200 engineers that were the best and then have them start designing, because it was it would have been a security clearance a disaster in the making, having so many people work on such highly classified information. So the military basically was introduced to how this one individual was, without much trouble at all, designing all these products for this company that was so large at the end of the 30s and was so far out in front of everybody else that they got the idea that, why not just have one guy do it? I mean, he does it successfully for the largest company in the world. Why can't he just, you know, especially if Detroit goes into a wartime mode where they're not going to be building products, for peacetime, they're going to be building for wartime. Why not just have that one individual take, and he's a patriotic patriarch, we might add, and he's like a great American. Why don't we just have him, once he, got his sworn to secrecy classification and all that, you know, Harley Earl basically became the largest individual who was designing products for the military. He just, it never came out. And you think about it, the design obsolescence that was used during World War II and leading up to World War II and after World War II was the most state-of-the-art in this country. And before World War II, I think everybody who's a World War II aficionado and historian would know that the technologically most sophisticated country in the world leading up to World War II was what was going on in Germany. The Teutonic engineering was considered the world's most premier engineering in the world, and their scientists and whatnot, and America was still second. And, Harley was at the forefront of creating this arsenal of democracy, which would also become the arsenal of design. And I'm sure a lot of your listeners are familiar with the World War II amphibious duck. That was a Harley Earl design. And the other huge area of Harley Earl's story, which I think will ultimately come out in a book someday, get people on Harley Earl's scent trail, was how, you know, General Motors bought North American Aviation in the depths of the Depression in 1933, and in 10 short years, by 43 and by 45, and at the end of the war, North American Aviation was the largest plane manufacturer in the world. Now, does that have something to do with Harley Earl and how he'd already done it in automobile building, bus building, truck building, train building, and designing and advanced concepting and prototyping? You betcha. It just hasn't come out. It's all been classified, since the innovator never wanted anybody to know. And for obvious reasons, he wanted to keep his anonymity and not, you know, as far as, you know, protecting one of America's greatest 20th century aero kings, designers during the war, before, during, and after the war. That was another reason he kept this a secret. GM protected Harley Earl. He wanted to be left alone to design, to dream, to figure out where we were going to go in the future. And no, I mean, it's just, I tell people today, you know, it's just, I mean, this did not happen by accident. You just look where the automobile industry was exactly 50 years ago. Right now, the American automobile industry in this country, General Motors, was, we're talking about, these things were the crown jewel of business and industry in the world. And to think five short decades later that General Motors doesn't even have a stock today, and it, you know, it's got an IPO coming up, but they don't even know where they came from, and they lost this legacy, and they lost this empire that, that Harley Earl was at the forefront of creating, which is, I call it Detroit's dependency on design. But, it's, of course, it's turned into everything today, and it's called the global automotive industry's dependency on design. This all came from one individual. If this individual had never moved from Hollywood to Detroit, it's a likely proposition that we might be all be driving variations of Model Ts and Yugos today.
It would be driving around Cracker Jack boxes with steering wheels.
Well, he really created the quantum leap in technology. And, of course, it had everything to do with, you know, GM's. And you look at the people who were his primary players and, you know, Big Bill Knutson, who was the general went from Washington, was the president of General Motors, went to Washington and became the general in charge of production, two-star general during the war. You look at C.E. Wilson, who later, under Eisenhower, became the Department of the, you know, the head of the Department of Defense under Eisenhower. These guys were all thick as thieves. You know, they were Harley's primary players, and this company was the one really that helped World War II end quickly because it was a war of attrition. They, of course, couldn't get to bombing our plants in the heartland of our country, and we could, I love the quote by Churchill, Germany built a fortress around Europe, by the beginning of the 40s, and but he forgot to build a roof over it, and we just bombed them into, that's why, of course, Japan and Germany were so vulnerable. Was air attacks, and we weren't in our heartland.
It's very true. So we're right now. We've probably taken this chronology into just about the end of World War II. Let's kind of pick it up there. We've got just a few minutes left in the
sure
the first hour of the program. We can go a little long, but. Let's talk a little bit about after the war, when so many of us were born, what kind of a role did Harley play upon the conclusion of World War II, and what was he involved in, and how did that manifest itself at General Motors?
Wow, that's a great question, Pete. You can really go in a lot of different directions, but I will say, coming out of the war, and Harley would be deposed by the end of the 50s, and we all look back today and we know that those were the golden era days of the automobile industry. And General Motors, after the war and going into the 50s, had a sales statistics explosion. They sold more cars than and became cemented near a 50% market share, and it all had to do with design of the automobile becoming their number one reason for car sales. Well, not surprisingly, by the end of Harley's run at General Motors by 1958, design was the number one reason for car sales in the automobile industry. And many would say, historians, business scholars, car aficionados, they know that design was the number one reason for car sales of the 20th century. And you just don't get a feather in your cap like that, and then the fact that nobody knows about it 50 years later without there being some sort of controversy involved. But the other thing I just want to talk to on a really positive note is where Harley went with these concept cars in the 50s and creating those state-of-the-art Motorama shows that were first kicked off at the Waldorf Astoria on Park Avenue in New York City. And Harley was creating these Motoramic masterpieces, him and his other designers, and by this time there were 600, there were 600 people working for Harley at his design department, which was called GM Styling by the beginning of the 50s. And by the time he would step down, there was more than 1,100 people working in design in the late 50s. But what's so important, you're talking about a department that during the first decade he was working with General Motors in the early 30s, was the only department, by the way, which was still growing during the depths of the Depression. Well, that's because, you put your money, you're going to put your money towards something that's growing and you believe is the future. And they were right. But the point is that these were the things that were taking the rest of the automobile and the American public into the future. I mean, look at the loyalty that came out of the 50s as far as people wanting to own American cars, moving into the future. Harley was in his last act, which he was not allowed to participate in, and he was betrayed in the late 50s by subordinates and financial treasury office administrators who wanted to break up his empire to get to all the money that was at as far as the creation of the automobiles at General Motors. But Harley essentially wanted to make sure that every fabulous five-car brand of General Motors back then, you had, Cadillac, Chevrolet, Buick, Oldsmobile, and Pontiac, and they were called the Fabulous Five. He saw that there was going to be an entry for a small car within each one of these major brands of General Motors. And, General Motors finance guys that betrayed Harley, in going into the 60s, they didn't want to build small cars. They were like, make a little more money on a big car. Why would we want to build small cars? We'll just build small cars forever. And once they basically smashed up his empire and dumped it into the cauldron of other great inventions, in areas of GM, it dulled the color and the life of the automobile design profession that's why it's become kind of a lost legacy of Harley Earl story, because Detroit's not doing, it doesn't, there's a tradition involved here as far as, building cars that Americans want to buy. And I call it, look, you got to have a sense of humor when you tell the story, because, let's face it, the last 50 years in General Motors history and Detroit is pretty abysmal. And, when Harley was betrayed and he was the golden goose behind this corporation and really driving the rest of the automobile industry forward, when he was betrayed, it kind of created a curse in Detroit. And, what you saw basically is kind of similar to the Babe leaving, Babe Ruth leaving Boston and going to New York, and the pennant, Boston not being able to win that for 80 years later or whatnot. I mean, you're talking about, you got to have a sense of humor. But the reason they can't build cars that Americans want to buy in Detroit today is that, think about it, they don't even really regard Harley Earl Story highly. They don't see him being like the individual. They don't recognize Harley Earl as the modern master that got us to where we are in the auto industry today, or creating the central universe behind what makes the modern auto industry tick today, which is where the birth of the car comes to life in every car company, this new profession that literally revolutionized the automobile world and is still revolutionizing the auto world. It's a great story. It's kind of exciting, because I think the end game will be when people finally do find out about Harley Earl, when there's a book and a movie and people understand that he's the Frank Lloyd Wright of the auto industry, or is the modern master. I think you're going to see people finally understand why Detroit could never build these cars over the last 50 years, because they kind of ruined the story that behind the individual that created the modern or modernity in not only automobiles but in manufacturing, mass manufacturing.
Well, at the point at which Harley Earl was no longer with General Motors, what did he go on to do after that?
That's an interesting question, because he had started his own design firm, during the war outside of General Motors. It was called the Harley Earl Corporation. And since he had invented the automobile design profession in the game of automaking, and I like to call it, by the end of the 50s, you could just call and see, this was something that GM was never going to let out because it was like so deeply suppressed, and it was part of their being, you know, their greatest trade secret. The automobile industry in the late 50s should have been called something else, and Harley knew this. It was, he had changed the entire game. The automobile business back then was the automobile design manufacturing business. But GM didn't want to let that story out so, you know, every other car company could follow in their footsteps. But the thing is after the war, you know, during World War II, Ford, they were like, they knew that Henry was going to die in a couple of years. He was very elderly, and he died in 1947, by the way. The Ford family members were friends with Harleys from Grosse Pointe, and they got an offer to him during the war. Look, come over to Ford. Bring all your designers. They don't have a contract with GM. Just bring them all over. You can put your name on the car or your sign it any way you want. You know how you used to sign it when you lived out in Hollywood. HJE was his signature mark for his initials. We'll pay you anything. And if that had happened, let's just say for argument's sake that Harley Earl had left General Motors after World War II and gone to Ford, Ford would have become the number one automobile manufacturer in the world again, and everybody would have known that would have happened because Harley Earl was the guy that was driving the fortunes of General Motors forward. So if he had gone to Ford with all his designers, just brought them all over, I mean, he would have left GM in a state where they would have lost the market share how Ford would have lost it in the mid-20s. So it would have been an interesting twist of fate. And the world as we know it would be different today because Ford would have been the number one leader probably for decades of time moving forward. But anyway, that's kind of an interesting sidebar. And I just think that, you know, Harley had a design firm after he retired. He was working closely, I think, with military leaders going into the 60s on all sorts of blue sky projects. And all of this information is classified. But, you know, you're talking Air Force One type stuff. You know, his alliance connection with some of the greatest leaders during World War II. I mean, I have these wonderful pictures, some of which are up on the website. You have Eisenhower driving around in one of Harley's greatest post-World War II concept cars. Curtis LeMay was one of Harley's closest hunting buddies. Hoyt Vandenberg, you know, these photographs at Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington, D.C. In the early 50s with all these military leaders in the background. And I mean, it's the astounding pictures of how this individual was a patriotic patriarch of this country. I call him an, America's Aero King. And he was doing all these things on the sly because, like I said, he wanted to keep his anonymity. Why is that so unusual? For a multitude of reasons. It's a great story. I think once people that have this particular sensitivity and this intellectual capacity to know more, they when they find out this story, they kind of breathe a big sigh and they go, wow, I always knew there was an individual behind this mighty corporation with a giant sword of power. And this story just answers all the questions of how General Motors became the greatest company of the last 100 years. And it's going to be a great story going forward because General Motors should be used as the first 50 years up to 58, you know, that's when GM was created in 1908. the first 50 years of GM is the greatest business story never told. And the story's never really been told from Harley Earl's perspective of how he created the number one reason for car sales by the end of his career in 1958, and how that affected the global automotive empire, created the global automotive industry's dependency on design. It's a fascinating story when you think you cannot make that statement if it wasn't for Harley Earl. There would have never been a dependency on design. And God help us to think where we'd be today and how primitive things would be as far as technology if we hadn't had this quantum leap that that took place in one of the largest industries that mankind or Western civilization has ever seen.
Well, this has been an interesting hour and some odd minutes, Richard. I can't thank you enough for being a guest on our show today. We're going to have to cut this off pretty quickly. I just want to remind everybody and tell everybody that the website is carofthecentury.com. All kinds of photographs, information, little-known facts. We didn't even get into a story about the background between the Fords and Harley Earl and what all that was involved in. And there's an article in there that I read. The pictures of some of these concept cars in the LaSalle and all these others, just absolutely amazing stuff. And if anybody that has been involved in the automobile industry or just has a passing interest in the automobile industry needs to know more about this era, this time in our history when all this was going on and how much was involved. It's just a phenomenal story. Some of the things we didn't get into today, and we didn't get into talking about these concept cars and how they're being sold for millions of dollars at the Barrett-Jackson Auto Auction right here in Scottsdale, Arizona. All the other things that have gone on with and around Harley Earl. We didn't talk about the fact that there is a NASCAR trophy that Harley Earl designed. I saw that video on YouTube, and we're going to be able to post that on our website as well. So just a great story and a lot of fun to talk about, and the fact that you and I have some parallel paths there having to do with Detroit and the automobile industry, and we didn't even get into all of those. So, Richard, thanks again for being a guest on the Boomer and the Babe show today. We really appreciate it. I'm sure you and I will be talking, and we'll set up a time when we can have you back on the show again. So thanks for being with us today, Richard. We do appreciate it.
Enjoyed it immensely. Thank you so much, Pete. No problem. Have a nice
day. Thank you. It was great.
Thanks. Have a great day yourself, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks for joining us today on the Boomer and the Babe show, when our guest has been Richard Earl, grandson of Harley Earl, the designer from General Motors back in the day. And sometimes people wish that we still had Harley Earl around, or at least the concepts and precepts of Harley Earl. You've been listening to the Boomer and the Babe show on Blog Talk Radio in Phoenix, Arizona, where we bring good conversation to the world. And today was an exceptional conversation, I might add. You are listening to the Boomer and the Babe show live every Monday through Friday at 10 a.m. right here on Blog Talk Radio. Remember to do one thing that we always ask you to do, and that's go visit our website at www.blogtalkradio.com and boomerandthebabe.com and see everything that we're involved in. We take a lot more information, and we do a lot more things other than just doing this radio program, but there's a lot of good information on the archives. Take a look at the Boomer series books as well and see what we have coming. So be sure to make the second half of your life the best half of your life, and have a great day, everybody, and we'll see you at the next show.
Listening to the Boomer and the Babe show, where we bring interesting conversation to the world. Be sure to follow us on Twitter, where we tweet as Boomer and Babe, and on Facebook as Pete Peters 47. As always, you can friend us on Blog Talk Radio or sign up for our newsletter at boomerandthebabe.com. Email us at host@boomerandthebabe.com with any of your comments. Remember, at 50, you're just getting started.